Okay, so I'm going to talk about the segmentation clock in zebrafish. And it was fantastic. I don't know how many of you heard Alexander talking on Thursday last week, but it's fantastic to have that as an introduction as well, because I think many of the general ideas and concepts he's already introduced, and I'm going to sort of replay them now in some sense, but focusing on what's happening in the zebrafish. And I think it's an interesting question. I'm not going to have any clear-cut answers today, I think. But I think it's an interesting question how different vertebrates are when they do something that looks as absolutely stereotypical and sort of canonical as forming a backbone. How many different ways there are to do that? So I think that's an open question. Okay. So I guess we, in the lab, we're inspired by the problems of developmental biology. And I'm thinking about the shape and the size and the number of elements in the adult. We'll, of course, go back to the embryo to look how they emerge. And in particular, and this is a thing that Alexander and I have in common, certainly, is the role of timing in those processes. And I think we still don't understand very much about the control of timing in perhaps in biology in general, but particularly in embryology. So we study the segmentation in the zebrafish. And this is, as you might remember, this is now still a consequence of my system update. So I will play it. That's working. Cool. Okay, so this is a zebrafish embryo growing without being embedded, just sitting in a cup, in an agarose substrate. You can see its head forming here. You can see its tail emerging from the yolk here. This is all yolk. It's going to eat that in the first 4 days. And you can see centrally in the body axis is the notochord running right down the middle. And you can see the segments forming from head to tail. That's going to loop. And I'll zoom in a bit more. So this is going to be the tail bud. And if you focus back up here, right behind the head, you can see one by one, we're looking lateral, of course, but there are pairs of somites forming. These are epithelial blocks of cells. In the case of the zebrafish, there's only about 200 or 300 cells in each somite, and you can see them budding off as boundaries form from this posterior area, the tail bud right back here, and the presymmetric mesoderm. Okay, so you can't really see the cells in this, clearly. So what I'd like to do is now zoom in to this tissue while it's growing using confocal microscope to give you a scale of the cells moving around in that process. So, body segments added rhythmically and sequentially. And now let's zoom into the tail, tip of the tail. So the yolk would be over here. Here's the central nervous system. Here's the epidermis. You can see a very thin layer of cells on the outside. This section through the animal, which runs along the animal, cuts through part of the tail bud through the presymmetric mesoderm here. And then you can see several somites, the most recently formed somites that have just formed. So this is tail somatogenesis, if you watch. You're looking at a histone H2A GFP tag. So there's a couple of things I wanted to point out from this rather simple movie, it's going to loop, is that when a somite forms on this end, it's, if you watch the sort of anterior end of the presymmetric mesoderm, there's relatively small movements of cells that bring about the forming somite. In fact, they don't tend to move around so much as just reorient and change their shape. And so it's this sequential reorganization of the cells that actually what corresponds to a new somite forming. And that really does separate that group of cells from the rest of the tissue. They form a basal surface on an epithelium, and they start putting fibronectin and forming a real physical barrier between the tissues. Okay, what you'll notice is that as each somite forms, which I just said, it depletes this tissue in some sense of all the cells in that somite. So they exit to the anterior. Now, the prismatic mesoderm does change its length quite dramatically over development. You would have seen that in that first movie. But from one segment to the next, pick in some sort of pseudo-steady state, and there are new cells being added continuously from the posterior. There's a number of ways they can come in, divide. Cells can advect in from an upper layer, ongoing gastrulation, and they're also squeezed in by convergence extension. But the net effect is that as cells are removed at this end, they're also added at some rate, some flux, coming in this posterior end. Okay, so a bit like Theseus's boat. Do you know the Theseus's boat story? So Theseus has a boat, goes out on an adventure, kills some harpies or something, boat gets damaged, comes back, he replaces any plank or spar or something that was damaged. Then turns out he has to go out on some new adventure, he goes out, boat gets damaged again, comes back again, and so slowly he replaces every piece of wood in the boat, but it's still Theseus' boat, clearly. I also like turning over your red blood cells or something. So that's kind of what the pre-Semitic mesoderm is during development. We call it a tissue as if it had a fixed set of cells, but it actually has a population of cells that continuously drift through this kind of developmental reference frame, if you like. And to make that a little more concrete, have a look at the tissue boundary here, the dorsal side of the pre-Semitic mesoderm, that row of cells just there, and compare it, relative movement, to the ventral surface of the central nervous system. What I hope you can see is that there's a shear between those two cells like that. I think it's a really good representation of the movement, the flow of cells from through the reference frame of this tissue. Okay, that gradual slow movement of cells is going to be really important. And in looking at all the patterns and phenomena that we are interested in, we have to keep track of the movement of the medium. It's a bit like you've got a wave pattern, you're looking at you've got a river or a canal, and you see waves moving along the surface of the canal, and you can see what velocity they move at. But if you want to know how they arose, what's driving them, you absolutely need to know what the direction and magnitude of the current is in the water beneath. Okay, so what I'm saying is we've got a slow current, but it's not nothing.
Okay. There's a parallel patterning system here from the Hox genes. Do you think of that as an independent system? Because they obviously have to be coordinated at the end. And of course, the neural tube and these mesoderm have to be coordinated.
Yeah. I think.
Are those separate problems, or are they getting solved also here at this stage?
I can speak for the experiments we've done in the zebrafish, where we have mutated some of the proteins, sort of jumping ahead, but if you bear with me, we've mutated one of the genes that appears to be able to set the period of the segmentation clock. So we make segments more slowly, and they're bigger along the axis. It's called Hess6. I'm not going to talk about it otherwise. And so the finished animal actually has fewer, longer segments, but it starts making segments at the same time as the siblings, and it stops making segments at the same time. And its body axis is the same length.
The Hox genes are in the same Z coordinates?
They are in the same Z coordinates. They are not registered to the ordinal number of the segment they were in the wild-type siblings. So Hox genes from that one experiment, and the same is true, for example, for the transition from ribs to hemolymph neural arches, thin insertion sites, the anus, everything. It all seems to have some general reference coordinate where it is in the body. I don't like saying it like that. But it is not listening to the number of segments it makes. In fact, the animal doesn't listen to the number of segments it makes either, because clearly it can make different kinds of segments. Okay, so that's just a diversion on Hoxes. I will come back to Hoxes just briefly. Okay, so now there's an old idea about how to use oscillators or clocks to pattern a growing embryo. It's a clock and wavefront model. And I'm not sure now how many of the people who work on the problem would take this model in all of its details literally. And it's a bit like what Alexander said about the S&P wave model of Goodwin and Cohen. You love the first 10 pages. This is also similarly, the original paper is also very, very long, but I think the core ideas are very simple and they're very powerful. So I'm going to illustrate them here. But two things, a clock and a wavefront. For the purposes of this illustration, I'm going to call them independent phenomena, but then we'll elaborate on that. Okay. So here's your clock. It's the bilaterally symmetrical posterior part of the mesoderm in the animal. Tail bud here, each arm of the presymmetric mesoderm, and this little square is supposed to be cell, and it's going to be still in the lab reference frame. Okay, so the clock is basically all of this tissue here. It's a collection of oscillators, and mark that just by having the cells go from dark blue around to white, to light blue, white, and then back to dark blue again. So just keep track of the phase. And they're going to oscillate, and then we're going to make the animal grow or elongate by adding more oscillators on this end, very, very simply, at a a certain rate, will add more oscillators on this end. Now, the wavefront, which is this black line here, is a rule. It's a wavefront of sudden cellular change. And in this model, what's going to happen is that wavefront will move with some velocity across this tissue, across this field of oscillating cells. And actually, in this case, it's going to move with an identical velocity to that which we're adding new oscillators at the end. So the total length of the tissue is not going to change. We call this the infinite snake, with homage to the spherical cow. I don't know if you know the spherical cow. Okay. And the rule is that as an oscillating cell hits the wavefront, or as it slides under the wavefront, whatever phase of oscillations it had, that is recorded. And the clock could be stopped, doesn't have to be stopped. The important thing is that the phase is read out in some way, and that information then is used for later patterning. And here's the thing going, okay, it's going to oscillate a couple of times. The tissue elongates as the wavefront moves across, and now that cell that was oscillating and was drifting through that tissue has exited the tissue, and now it's taken its part in a segment. So this permanent spatial periodic pattern here is in some sense measured the temporal pattern and also measured the velocity of the wavefront. So the segment length is given by the velocity of the wavefront, by the period of the clock. Okay, now that's the general key elements of the model, and it doesn't matter what the molecular or microscopic components are. The only thing that I do want to sort of hint at here or foreshadow is, originally Cook and Zeeman, they were interested in the scaling problem, which is how the pattern of an embryo scales to its start size, so the initial conditions. And they proposed this model initially as a way that they might solve that problem. In order to do so, I think that it was necessary that this wavefront was, in their model, was independent. So it was an independent process. But of course, you could imagine that it's being instructed from somewhere else, information coming in. But it could be that the position of that wavefront in the tissue is being set by this tissue and is being dragged with the tissue as it elongates. You could imagine that it's being continuously informed from this end, although I think your experiments where you don't see, where you can form a new boundary without any conditions on the outside sort of speaks against that. So I'm going to be agnostic about what that wavefront is, and we'll try and come back to that. Okay. Good. Okay. So now what you noticed was that the phase was uniform across that tissue. Frequency and phase is uniform across the tissue. But when we go to any vertebrate, and this is now a zebrafish carrying two transgenes, we do not see that phase is uniform across the tissue. We see these beautiful waves of gene expression moving through the tissue. So this is what it looks like in a zebrafish. Starting off at about the three-segment stage, you can see three bands of a gene called MESP-B, which this gene marks the anterior row of cells in each newly formed segment. As that segment's made, those cells switch MESP on. For us today, it absolutely doesn't matter what MESP does, actually, in those cells, just that it's expressed exactly in these cells. The other gene is a gene called HER1, and I'll talk about that one in just a sec a bit more, but it's a transcription factor. We've tagged it with YFP, and it has a very short half-life. So effectively, when we first see it, it's already in the nucleus, and then it's actually degraded in the nucleus. You can't see nuclei in this movie, but what you can see is the tissue scale patterns. So what I hope you can see is that as each segment is added, it's marked with this MESP transgene expression on the anterior side. And at the same time, there are a continuous series of waves leaving from the tail bud, moving through the tissue, slowing down, and where they stop, and this is just a description of the coincidence, where they stop is where the MESP comes on. It marks the forming somite boundary, and it also marks where the MESP is expressed. So this is the segmentation clock in a zebrafish. We saw it in a mouse last week. This is what it looks like in a zebrafish. Okay, so we start off with a very long tissue, which has about three waves in transit at any one time. And by the end of this movie, we've shrunk the tissue well over to half its length, and we end up with having, on average, just one wave in transit by about the time we're making the 20th signal. Yeah, Ari.
By imagination, or do you get waves of the green moving in both directions and where they hit each other? That's for you.
No, that's your imagination, and it's. but it is a very common imagination to have. Partly because what your brain is doing is this. Position is not holding constant in your field of view, it's moving this way. If I'll show you a chimer graph that we can anchor that tissue, and then you see that it doesn't move, it doesn't come back again. Although in principle there's no reason why a wave couldn't move in either direction. Yeah.
The progenitor is always the source of the wave, because clearly I cannot see the green in the
ah, yes. Because this movie has got three channels blended together. It looks that for some parts of the movie you don't see any green in the tip, but those cells do oscillate the whole time. They have a lower amplitude. And actually, Alexander, you mentioned this amplitude difference, right? There's absolutely a sort of an amplitude gradient, lower amplitude oscillations here and higher oscillations there. I'll show you what that looks like in a bit more detail. So let's go to look at this pattern at a single cell resolution, again using a confocal microscope, and going to track this. And just image this. Now we're back to this orientation with the tail here. Central nervous system, I think you can just see up here, is the tail bud and the presynaptic mesoderm. So now you can see each of these cells is becoming bright and dark. Each of these nuclei is becoming bright and dark successively. And there's a little bit of jitter. That's mainly because of our registration algorithm, not because the animal's shaking around. Just to keep that tissue in the center of the movie that I'm playing. Otherwise, the animal's growing so fast that the tip of the tail would have already shot out the side of the slide. Yep.
What's the typical cell division time relative to the period of the oscillation?
That's cell division times here are around about, in the mesoderm, are probably about 8 to 10 hours. And the period here is strongly temperature sensitive, but it's on the order of 30 minutes. 30 minutes, 40 minutes in that order. So it's much, much longer than. And in fact, Scott Holley's lab showed with a mutation that stops the cell cycle at the onset of segmentation that the animal still produced its first 18 segments fine. So to first approximation, I actually don't think there's any connection between the cell cycle and this clock. First approximation. Okay, so there's the phenomenology at the level of the cells. So now, what are the individual cells doing? And I want to just sketch our. So we've got a population of oscillating cells in the tissue. They're spatially coordinated to give this that gives rise to this wave of gene expression that sweeps through the tissue. Every time one of these waves arrives in the anterior, there's a new segment formed. What do we think is going on inside the cells that might give rise to the instability to this oscillation? And our current model in the field. Is that this might depend on a class of transcription factors, basic helix-loop-helix transcription factors of the Hess-Hairy related family. And actually we heard in several talks already about them playing various roles in development. The key things for us are that they form homone heterodimers. Here's the DNA binding to DNA, sequence-specific binding. And the simple model we have in the field at the moment is that the transcription of one of these genes, translation of the protein products, their dimerization, re-entry into the nucleus, completes a very simple negative feedback loop that could give rise to oscillations. And in this kind of simplified model, it will oscillate if the stability of the mRNA in the protein is balanced with the production times through the loop. If those two timescales are in the right ratio, then that will sustain oscillations. And under those circumstances, the period is given by the delays and the half-lives of the protein. So that just to give you a feel for what we think is probably in each of these cells keeping the time. Now, I'm being a bit careful there because I don't think the field has ironclad evidence that that is actually true. We've got quite a lot of circumstantial evidence, and for example, I mentioned one of the experiments before. Can you take these proteins and change the period and nothing else? So I think but still that doesn't mean that still nobody's been able to go in, change the properties of the molecules in this loop, and predict and control the output period of the oscillator. So I think
I thought there was a Japanese paper that fiddled with an intron or the 5' UTR of Hess and changed the period.
There is a Japanese paper from Ryo Kageyama. So Ryo's lab has made, I think, two really important papers. One is that they've changed intron numbers in the gene to try and change the length of time it takes to make. And I think they've done that. The clock sped up for a few cycles and then it crashed. And the other paper they did, which is also technically, I think, very good, was they managed to change the half-life of the Hess-Hirth protein, although they could never measure it in vivo. They measured it in cell lines. And there again, the clock crashed. And so those models ended up saying that, well, for some ranks, volume in parameter space, the clock is unstable, just like we predicted. But there's lots of ways to break a clock, and once it's broken, I think, as a field, we need to insist that the clock keeps running. They scan through all of the light. So they in the fish and in the mouse, it's the half-life of the Hess protein is controlled by ubiquitination and degradation of the proteasome. And so they fiddled with the different lysines and made variants that in, I think, 3T3 cells had quite different half-lives. And then they put that lysine variant back into the mouse and looked whether they could change the speed of the clock.
So which way can
they change it? Yes, they put a single variant back into the mouse. And did they make more of it, more or less? Because they had two variants in the cell. Does anyone remember? I'll get back to you. I think it was a longer half-life.
Fold-wise?
Or 20%, 30%? Yeah, quite small. Yeah, I wonder whether there's a limit to how much you can move a molecular oscillator in any direction, potentially because there are lots of timescales that have to be balanced as you go around that circuit. And I'm unsure that if you just took one of the components and made it tenfold different, whether that would... So let's bear this in mind because I want you to have some sort of idea for what's happening in individual cells. Okay, and so it was HER1 that we tagged. That was the oscillating transgene that I'm going to keep talking about. So something that's doing this continuously in those cells. Okay, so that's one kind of model. Here's another kind of model. Obviously, segmentation clock is kind of amazing, pattern phenomenon going on in the embryo. And it's deeply influenced the transport for London, and they've installed these segmentation clock simulators on all the tubes. So here's a segmentation clock simulator running. So there is really some good analogies here, and there's one that's missing. And so I'll say what they are. First of all, when you look at this pattern, you can say why is a single pixel switching on and off? So you look at that, you see. See that zoom in, you see single pixels blinking on and off, and then on and off, and you see that they're periodic. So you can ask questions, why is a pixel blinking on and off? Then, if you broaden your view out a little bit, you can see actually that if a given pixel is on, its neighbours are also very likely to be on, or if it's off, its neighbours are also very likely to be off. So there's some local correlation in the pixels, so you can ask questions about that too. How does that work? But of course, what we notice at first is the global organisation of the pattern here. We perceive this as words moving across the frame here. Next station is Moorgate. Sorry for the inconvenience. So you can imagine. So we can ask questions about, well, how come this particular spatial organisation is there in the thing? Now, of course, we know that engineers built this, and the words are information for us. But you could also imagine that, you could have a rule where when the M gets to that end, you make a new segment. So you can have quite a complex pattern that repeats over and over and gives rise to some sort of repetitive phenomena. Okay, now, every pixel in here has the same period. So this is some sort of steady state, some sort of oscillating steady state. And the other thing that doesn't happen here is that pixels never enter or leave the frame. So this is like a snapshot where only the oscillation is happening. There are no cells entering or leaving. So, okay, so I think we can ask questions at all these different levels. They've got to interact somehow, presumably. How do they interact? I think we don't know the answer to a lot of those questions. But I think that's a good way to frame the question in some ways. So I'm gonna come back to the pattern, the spatial pattern, following on from what Alexander was talking about these sort of global patterns and how they arise. Okay, so we would say then, converting that back to biology, that segmentation clock is trying to be quite generic here, is a tissue level rhythmic pattern formation, pattern generator. So it has cellular oscillators, which are probably ticking because of some sort of negative feedback loop. We have evidence now in the zebrafish that this is cell autonomous. The cells are locally synchronized to each other, and we have evidence, I think, now from mouse, as well as quite a lot from zebrafish, that this local synchronization is driven by delta notch cell-cell signaling, and this will feature in a minute. And finally, what's probably most obvious are these tissue-level wave patterns, which span now hundreds of micrometers across the tissue. And these change not only in a periodic fashion, but also through development, they change their spatial wavelength and their numbers. So I'm going to come back to that a bit later. Okay, so now, tissue-level wave patterns. So the question I wanted to look at today, and now everything's unpublished. So this is kind of like a lab meeting, and anything you say will be held against you. but I haven't made up my mind about all of these things, and so if you have ideas, that's great, I'll steal them. And it'd be really, really good for feedback. Thank you. Okay, so here's a sort of general topic here, is what generates these patterns? And I'm interested, first of all, in saying, what are the cells doing? What organization do the cells have in order to give rise to these patterns? So, I think, did that movie play at the top? People are watching. Yeah? Okay. So, if you take a line intensity along that axis of the tissue, you've got distance here and time here. All my chymographs are going to have distance across and time down. And I'm going to try, I think, hopefully, all of them will have the posterior tip of the embryo in the left corner. That's the reference frame. Okay, so we've got these waves of gene expression. You can see that they're fairly well phase synchronized in the posterior, and then this is a signature of them slowing down, and then the cells stop oscillating and they differentiate and they express this MESP marker. So let's take these two elements of pattern and see if we can understand how they come about. What can we understand about that? So, maybe what you can see in a bit more resolution, a bit more detail here, is that just how close that apposition is as each wave comes in to where the new boundary is and where the MESP is expressed. It's almost like a handover. Cells oscillating, slows down, and hands over to the red gene. Okay, now, yeah.
What the chymograph looks like is a function of how you choose to take your slice. How do you determine where to take your slice?
So what I'm going to be showing is always lateral views of the animal like this. And what we do is we use the notochord as a guide. Can you see there's this double tram track here?
Yeah.
So the embryo is transparent enough that you can nearly always see the notochord at most stages of development. And what we do is we run our line of interest basically along that axis. And then we sort of interpolate out to the tip of the tail. So I guess exactly the angle here is maybe a bit fuzzy. I don't have a ironclad rule for hitting the back of the tissue. Does that make sense? And so then we take that and we straighten it and we put it there. And then each time step we just put a new, in this case it's floating actually, because what you see here, it wasn't the best example actually, but can you see the tissue growing posteriorly? And I just told you that I was going to anchor it there.
I didn't.
Sorry. Yeah. So actually, if you want to put that in the reference frame of the posterior tip, sorry, we have to correct there. Bring that round, and that will shear all of the lines in this direction.
But it really looks like
staring at the lamp frame is very useful because right there are these nearly vertical red stripes, and so we kind of impose the boundary condition on the traveling wave, which does something when it hits the stripe. So what happens to the very first stripe when it is laid down?
Yep.
So the very first soma.
In the early embryo.
Right? Yeah. So when this traveling wave hits and lays down the first soma, what is happening at that point?
That's a super, it's a super question. I don't think we know, really. We know that the embryo starts oscillating just before gastrulation, and it does three waves before it does three pulses that are toroidal around the early germ ring in the zebrafish before the first traveling wave departs. So it has three warm-up oscillations, and then it has a traveling wave that comes up along the sphere.
So oscillations before anything starts traveling.
The first one is definitely, we don't see any spatial distribution. The second one, there might be slight, what would that you would call ventral to dorsal offset. And then this sort of offset across the animal grows for the first several hours. And then you get a traveling wave that clearly leaves the posterior tissue or ventral tissue at that stage. But the answer, I don't know. I don't know. So we filmed the first wave that comes in and makes a segment, but I can't tell you anything about that that makes it look different. So I think we really don't know why that wave, and not one of the ones before, was selected to be the one to supply the information. Yeah. It's clearly not sufficient to lay down a segment anywhere either, right?
So maybe you said this, and I missed it. I mean, do you know that this is a propagating wave versus just a kinematic wave?
It's a kinematic wave.
It's a kinematic wave.
Sorry, yes. It's a kinematic wave.
What is the gene differentiation marker that you're using?
It's called, this one is called MESP-BB.
So in the chymograph, if I look at the first time point and I pick three cells, how would the cells, and I track the cells, how would the cells look like in the chymograph? Would it go down straight or would it go from...
So you would, it would be easier to do if I hadn't accidentally made this, but I show you one with a straight in a minute. And from tracking cells, and also from labeling clusters of cells and watch them come out of the tailbone and swift across the tissue, it's surprising how linear their movement is through the tissue. Yeah, so I think you could think of the cell movement as some straight line at an angle across the tissue here.
You said before that the length of the green pattern shrinks over time. Is that a continuous thing? Does that constantly shrink? Because it sort of seems like over the time of these like 3 seconds, it sort of stays constant.
Oh, sure. So maybe if you recall the first movie I showed you, I think if you would take any small number of segments, neighboring segments, you would think that the tissue had the same length. It's only when you take a step back and look at all of the segments forming, you see that there's a continuous, in the case of the zebrafish, a continuous shortening of the PSN. Although, not to confuse things, but Boris, if you look before the first segment is formed, the oscillating tissue grows, sort of extends in length, and then it shrinks again. And I think, Alexander, you have to correct me, but I think in the amniotes, the tissue also grows and shrinks again.
Yeah, we have much more of a growth phase also during development.
I mean, the mouse really grows. The fish segments and extends, but it doesn't actually grow very much during this phase. Okay.
Is the irrelevant relevant? Is the yolk consumed only from one side?
No, as far I don't know. It doesn't look like it's nibbled up from one end. The surface of the yolk expresses a whole bunch of genes that are later found in the liver of the fish, and so I think it's some sort of embryonic. Sort of extra embryonic primordial liver that from which all of these lipids and protein resources get broken down, metabolized, and pushed, taken up into the body to be. But the yolk is consumed, so you can see it deforming there.
Yep.
But that's not consumption. So the yolk is not visibly consumed. What does visibly mean? I mean, around about day 2 and 3, you can start to see the thing, and it's gone by about day 5 or 6. And so everything we're going to look at today happens in the first day and a half.
When it comes to growth, in the production of new cells of the posterior, what is the source of the material?
It has to be the oak, because the...
So that's why I'm asking you the consumption.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so, right? I guess that the best way to get something to here is from the tip of the yolk, but that yolk extension is growing continuously for about 5 or 6 hours, and then it slows its growth, the extension rather, and I suppose that it's being continuously consumed through development. I'm not aware of any studies that look at the depletion of the yolk in some sort of way. And the deformation of the yolk is spectacular. I think we don't actually understand how the yolk deforms.
Just to understand a bit more, how is the speed of the cell divisions at the growth zone with respect to the oscillation that is?
I think we had that question before, yeah. About the cell division time and the oscillations. The cells are dividing much, much slower. Maybe 10 times slower than the cell cycle, than the segmentation clock cycle.
So if I look at the camera, it seems that these green lines they're kind of a curve, as if the signal starts really where it's bright, and then it goes towards the tail bud, and then also towards the anterior part. So it doesn't seem to really goes from the tail bud to the anterior part, but there's like an intermediate point to which it kind of then goes in both directions. And in Demi, if you look at the movie, it really seems like this.
I mean, I agree, particularly this top curve looks like it's continuously curved.
Black curve, black.
Yeah, I agree.
There are two directions, in fact.
I mean, when the tail bud is very long, in the posterior, we sometimes see waves going posteriorly from the posterior end of the notochord, as if they are moving out concentrically from a position quite posterior. So the posterior end of the notochord is about here. So I think that's probably right. I think there, particularly in the early stages, you can see a slight posterior movement. Yeah, I think that's probably right. I think maybe that this, I'm not going to show this kind of graph again. potentially because of the way we've drawn it in this case or something, I think it's exaggerating that.
But apart from the arc, I mean, the brighter signal is clearly not from the posterior tip. I mean, it's really in an intermediate.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Okay. Here's one more thing to be careful about. What these are saturated pixels here. So just one has to be careful not to confuse the intensity with the phase. And so when we take the entire part of zebrafish, we take all of zebrafish segmentation, and we convert the we run pixels down and calculate the phase this way, then these little twists, they basically disappear. The downward curving. So yeah, can I leave it there for now? Anyone who wants to see waves traveling backwards?
I'm a bit confused about the previous question. You said that these are kinematic waves.
Kinematic
waves. Sorry. What do you mean by that?
So can distinguish them from a dynamic wave, where there's a transfer of energy along the direction of propagation of the wave. In this case, the idea is that, and actually Alexander talked about this in his talk, that some of the first studies that saw this put barriers in the tissue and saw that even anterior to the barrier in the direction of propagation, this side kept oscillating with the barrier in place. So there can't be any transmission that's required from this cell to this cell in order to get the wave to go. So that means a kinematic wave is a wave that appears due to the differences in timing of its constituents. Yeah. And what I'll show you later on in the talk, maybe if I get there, is that the cells, each cell individually, can oscillate without any other cell nearby. So it cannot be a transmission of a wave.
So the cells are moving as well because
it's okay. So that's really important. The cells are slowly drifting in this reference frame, but there was a question about where, how you would draw the. If you think about the, let's make this an sort of an average velocity of the phase. Forget about the curve here, and then so that would, that angle gives us the velocity, and the velocity of the cells in the reference frame is like this. And of course, the observed pattern is those two superimposed, but. It is not the movement of cells that's causing that phenomenology. Yeah. So this is, now I want to talk about the slowing of individual oscillators in the tissue. This is what I showed you in the beginning. We have a uniform phase across the tissue. Got a cell drifting in that tissue, and it's ejected at the end, stops oscillating, and makes part of a soma. And so in this simulation, that cell maintained a constant frequency, and then it stopped oscillating. It actually, in this case, we took its frequency to zero and we read off its phase just before we stopped it. So this was the idea of the original clock and wavefront model, but of course there's no waves in here. And what we can do is, let me just see where I've got. What we can do is we can ask the cell to start with the same frequency, to end with the same frequency in the same position, but to slow gradually. So now we're going to follow that cell, and what happens as a result of a cell slowing gradually is the phase to its neighbours continuously grows. And as that phase grows, that's what you see, the difference between two neighbouring clocks spread across the axis is what gives us our stripes. So all we've done between these two simulations is changed the rate at which the cell slows down. Instead of stopping suddenly at the anterior end, it slows gradually and stops, and that's sufficient to get that pattern. And if you know your pattern, you can tune this rate and see what frequency profile would give rise to a particular pattern that you have. Again, this is in our infinite snakes. So then, of course, if you jump on the reference frame of the cell, what you'll see is that the cell is oscillating quickly in the posterior, and then it slows its oscillations, and then it stops. So that's exactly what this group of cells did, or individual cell did in that. So this is the theory, and now the question is, one more thing to say. So I really want to emphasize this rate of slowing as central to the pattern, okay? Because what we could do, so what I showed you previously was this a sudden stop, sorry, I've changed orientation now, a gradual stop, which would give us three waves, but you could put whatever shape for a frequency profile you like. In fact, that's a good way to get the waves to go backwards. And here are, corresponding to these three frequency profiles of the individual cells as they drift through the tissue, the expected tissue level patterns that you would see. No profile, what we call the mouse pattern, which corresponds to effectively sort of 2π offset across the tissue, on average one wave sweeping through the tissue at a time, at a given developmental stage, and the, quote, zebrafish pattern, where you have three waves moving through the tissue. So you want a different pattern, all you have to do is tune the rate of slowing. Okay, that's the thing. So, do they, in fact, slow in the tissue? And Alexander, I'm not sure you showed the data yesterday, but you mentioned that you had tracked cells in the tissue.
Okay. I didn't show them.
Okay, right. So what I'm going to do now is show the data from the zebrafish. This is work done by David Richmond in the lab. And what we do here is we go back to these time-lapse movies in the confocal, and we pick up a group of cells that we call a columnar cohort. So these are cells that share the same anterior posterior position along the axis, but an identical DV position. We don't want to compare cells that are spread along the axis because they already have a phase difference. And if they're slowing, then things are going to get pretty confusing pretty fast. So columnar cohort, we pick them up in an animal that has its nuclei labeled with the histone marker. And in another channel, the cyclic protein is oscillating in a different fluorophore. So pick up those guys. And here are the fluorescence intensity traces normalized to the histone. And these are now, I think, six cells that were in this cohort, and they do their first cycle together, the second cycle together, the third cycle together, the fourth cycle, amplitudes, you see amplitudes growing on average, and at this point they exit into a somite, and we don't follow them anymore. We pick them up not in the very posterior in the tailbone because the cells are moving around so fast there that it's still hard to track. I think we solved that problem, but we hadn't at the time now. And then, so we're watching them drift from the posterior part of the tailbone into the somite.
I know that you don't track.
No. And you could see that, in some sense, from the chymographs, how the green stripes came over and just died out.
Is this arrest a separate process? So why do they exit? So it's a, in some, I know that cells are talking to each other, but in some sense, the model that you paint with the negative feedback is a cell autonomous model.
Yep.
So why do they exit?
I think that's a super question. I think we don't know. I'm going to show you some things that we've discovered recently about things that might influence that, but I think that somehow that oscillating cell has to be pulled off its limit cycle. Somehow. So how do we do that? That's a good question. Yeah.
Is there a fixed number of oscillation? A given number that could stop?
At a given developmental time, these movies were made at around about the 15 somite stage. Uh-huh. This is very, very typical. They'll do four cycles as they drift across the tissue. And you think, so we haven't measured this at sickle cell resolution throughout development, but when the tissue is very, very long, those cells are not moving very different velocity in the reference frame, and so they will do many more oscillations before they're finally ejected out of the tissue. But at this stage, it's very typical of cells to do that. Actually, just have a look here. I don't know if you can see, there's a light blue cell. It actually missed a cycle, and then it kicked back in again, and then it... So there's, I mean, you probably saw from those movies, these are quite noisy oscillations. I don't want to put my hand in the fire on that transgene to give you a number for the noise, because the transgene itself has some bioactivity and it could be putting a weak perturbation into the system. So for now, I just say it's quite noisy. On average, these are very well temporally correlated, but individual cells still fluctuate. Otto.
Looking at variability in a column, as you described it,
yep.
By the time the red comes on, I'm referring to the red in the previous yep. chymograph, there it looks like the columns are lock and step with each other.
Uh-huh.
At this point, you still see variability in a column.
The red's coming up here.
Red's coming up there.
Yeah. So I think what... So Ari, get to you in one sec. One thing is that when we look... at the variability, and we very quickly use differences in amplitude. That's the thing that really strikes you. And so what we try to do here is to detrend that and look at the difference in the timing mm-hmm. of the cycles. And that seems to be quite high, the correlation seems to be very strong
throughout.
Yeah, in time. Whereas in the amplitude, that seems to be fluctuating around a bit. Although, again, as you pointed out, there's always a gradual increase across the tissue. I think there was one. Yeah, Ari, sorry.
So you called something on the previous slide a mouse pattern.
Yeah.
Can you say a word about what the differences are between fish and mouse?
Yeah, I'm in the mouse. Well, okay, in the mouse, I think it depends on the window in which you're measuring, but so far in the movies that you guys have made, and also Rio, the number of waves that are in motion in the tissue at any given time, another way of saying that is the total phase offset between the anterior and the posterior, is about 2 pi. It's about one wave, and that's in fact what you found in your cultures, right? It really is very, very reliably one wave, 2 pi phase offset. I don't know. We've never looked at the mouse, but there's some indications that the wave number might change. The number of waves might change.
Yeah, from snapshots, we would see that over developmental time, that wave number would change. So early embryos would also have 2 waves, maybe not 3, but that would change over long time scales.
And in the zebrafish, we start off with something around 3, 3.5 when it starts, and we end up with 2 pi by the end of development. There's a continuous eating up of the phase difference, if you like, in the tissue.
And I'm sorry, is there really a difference between the fish and the mouse, or just depends when you're looking at
I don't know. I mean, I think that's a good question. Yeah. I mean, there are lots of differences if you've ever tried to.
But in terms of the clock.
Yeah, I think there could well be differences. I mean, I think Alexander was pointing out how difficult it is to image mice for a long period of time under the microscope. So the fish is easy. So for us, we can look at the whole thing, and then so we can see all the changes in the waves. I think it's extremely technically difficult to try and make those measurements in the mouse. Now, I encourage them to do it, because I would like to actually line the two guys up side by side and see what the differences are over development time. But I think we don't know, right?
We'll try our best.
Of course you do.
I'll come back to you. But it's true.
Could there be a difference in growth? I mean, maybe in one case growth is increasing, I mean, it's accelerating, in the other case not. I mean, this is something we have the impression that we still don't manage to take into account. Do all the models and all the analysis. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, for sure that's true. I mean, the mouse and the chick both grow massively during the days of timescale that they spend making segments. The fish elongates its body dramatically. It doesn't increase the volume of its tissue very much in that time, and it's all done in 24 hours. So I think it's going to, for a complete description to understand these things, it's going to be very difficult. But let me come back and say, as long as we keep track of the flux of the material relative to the phase of the oscillators, we have to keep making sure we're not convolving them when we say something about the system. So in order to take into account growth or tissue flow or cell movements, and then have the pattern and say, okay, how much of that pattern in the imaging frame comes from drift of the material and how much of it comes from a phase difference and these kinds of things. But I don't see there's any reason why we won't do that in the mouse and the chick, for example. There could really be big differences between these clocks, though. I mean, I think we don't know, but just look at the genetics, the gene lists of which the genes are oscillating. There's some other differences that I come to in a sec. Yeah.
So with the amplitude increasing and whatnot, it somehow looks like a resonance effect. So you somehow hit the eigenfrequency of the cells. Does the eigenfrequency depend on what cell type you have, or like if you go like longer down the tail, does it change?
Oh, that's a really good question. What I'm going to talk about next is that this frequency is growing. So you're saying, okay, now we're as the frequency it grows, and now we are locking onto an eigenfrequency, and our amplitude's growing. Could be, and then maybe we die. Maybe we get amplitude death after that. I don't think we have a good enough understanding of what's going on. But I think these are the right ways to think about this data and say, okay, could it be like this? If it was like that, how would we stop that happening?
Did you say the frequency is growing or the period is growing?
Period's growing, sorry. Frequency's time away, sorry. Okay, so the question here, so this is what the cells are doing individually, and now we can ask the question, remember the prediction was, and this is exactly what Alexander was saying the other day, that in order to get these waves that are shortening their wavelength as they move across the tissue, the cells ought to be slowing. So now what we can do very simply is for each of the cells that we've tracked, we just measure the ratio of successive interpeak times, and we can plot them on a graph like this, and so what you can see here is that nearly all of the cells lie on this side of the equivalence line, which means that nearly every time the cell does another cycle, it's longer than the last one it did. Not always, but nearly always. And that January the 5th, you can see how long it takes to publish anything in our lab. Just a warning, if you're actually going to think you want to join the lab. This is January 5th, 2013, so be warned. That's my birthday. And that reminds me that it's someone else's birthday today. Happy birthday, Boris. It's compulsory in my laboratory to do an experiment on my birthday. It's lots of fun for everyone. Okay, so four different embryos with all of their columnar cohorts measured, or many of their columnar cohorts measured, and so this is quite robust. On average, 20% slowing as the cells slow down. So that's what we think. We really think so. Individual cells do really slow their frequency across the zebrafish PSM. And so this is the conclusion we'd like to draw from that the wave patterns arise because as the cells are moving across the tissue, they're gradually slowing their oscillation. That's sort of like the cellular level description of why there are waves there.
Okay. Could you have a way experimentally of distinguishing between cells are measuring elapsed time and just slowing down versus they're measuring where they are relative?
Yeah, super, super question. Positional information versus some sort of timer or... getting external information, it's exactly that I want to go to. So let's now ask the question. So now this is agnostic about why they're slowing and why they go the length of time they do before they stop. And so now we want to dig into that and see if we can understand how they are slowed and stopped. Can we learn anything about that? So first of all, I want to tackle this question at the level of local synchronization and ask whether coupling between oscillators could give waves. And could some sort of complex coupling slow them and stop them? I think it's a reasonable question because that sort of behavior can indeed happen between coupled oscillators. These are one of my favorite examples at the moment. This is from a paper from Jeff Hastings' lab, who built bacteria that have a synthetic quorum sensing circuit, and when they get to a certain density, they will start to signal each other and they'll kick off cycles of gene expression. Now we know these individual bacteria cannot oscillate by themselves. They must talk to their neighbors to oscillate by design and also by actually when you measure them. But have a look what they do. Okay. Bang. So this looks on the surface quite a lot like the waves that we've been seeing, right? There's an initial phase where it gets beautiful waves, and then it breaks up into be a bit more patchy, and it can depend on how fast you flush the cells and how wide the thing is. But that's Jeff's story, and it's a really good one, so have a look at this paper if you like. So I just want to put that out there, because... So now, Philip Murray, working with Ruth Baker and Phil Maney, they wrote a model in which oscillator coupling plays a fundamentally important role in the slowing of oscillations along the anterior-posterior axis of the tissue, not of the global animal, but in that tissue. So I think this idea is out there for the PSM. It's there in a lot of other systems. So we can test that, right? So let's give it a test. Okay, it's one of those movies. So what we think is doing coupling between neighboring oscillators, and this again harkens back to stuff that Alexander told you, was delta notch. So imagine now we have one of these negative feedback loops in this cell and one in that cell, just of the kind I told you, the HER1 negative feedback loop, and the HER1 is repressing, in this case it's a repressor, the expression of delta on the surface of the cell. The neighboring cell, all of these cells express notch on their surface, more or less continuously. And so every time there's a pulse of delta on the surface, there's some phase information, biochemically encoded, coming into the neighboring cell, and that can alter the frequency with which that cell ticks. So it can speed it up, slow it down, and they can, in that way, adjust phases. The idea we have at the moment is that's continuous coupling and it's reciprocal. That's probably a massive simplification. So let me just exit here, and I want to show you this animation. We don't have a transgene at the moment that I can show you a delta gene oscillating. We're still trying to build one. But this is delta C mRNA, and it's a cartoon that I made. Of snapshots of animals all about the same stage, and I've ordered them now so you can see these bursts of delta C mRNA and the waves moving up the tissue, shortening and arresting here in the anterior. So this. Six or seven? And this one here? So, of course, so this is illustrative. But what it is meant to show you is that we have reason to believe that the delta gene is oscillating in the cells. And actually now, Ryuichiro Kageyama has tagged delta-like 1 in the mouse, and it shows very similar. Well, it shows a cyclic pattern. It shows the wave. So let's go back to.
Is it Bellerin at all? Like, could it be your boundary of the wave? Like, intensity seems higher and much better defined than the posterior boundary.
Right, so there's been a few comments now about the amplitude rising in the anterior, so that's again what you're seeing. And indeed, I think all of our measurements are, particularly on the level of endogenous mRNA, is that the anterior boundary gets much sharper. And I think that's a question that we don't quite understand yet, and whether there's some feedback between the tissue mechanics in the anterior, or, we would like to try that in the prep next week. Some issues related to that. Okay, so, Madhav.
Actually, talking about positional information, one of the things that you started right at the beginning was this nuclear movie. And you clearly saw the somites, and then these nuclei, the edge of the somites line up.
They
really look much more columnar.
Yeah.
So I guess more asking for a comment, certainly because of the mechanics, they kind of lined up in a column as opposed to being some sort of staggered. Do you think that's that lining up allows those cells to sort of do the patterning more lock in step with each other? Because now they are in the same sort of coordinate in terms of distance from...
That lining up orthogonal to the long tissue axis,
right.
That is very late in the
process.
Very late. But it could correspond to exactly the very sharp dark stripe that you saw right in the anterior. There's a gradual sharpening, which we don't understand, but right in the anterior, it gets pretty sharp. Yeah. Okay. So now, this is how we think about Delphinox signaling in the fish. If we take DAPT, which will block the cleavage of the Notch receptor and stop Notch signaling between cells in the tissue, put the embryos in DAPT and it blocks all the Notch signaling, we grow those animals up, and then afterwards we look at what segments they made. It turns out, even though we added DAPT before gastrulation in this case, this animal could still make around about 10 good segments, and then it suddenly underwent a sort of catastrophic failure of segmentation. So, despite the fact that Delphinox signaling wasn't working, it could still make good segments of the anterior. And when we look again at these patterns of underlying cyclic gene expression, we can see in the presence of DAPT across here that these wave patterns gradually get worse and worse. They lose coherence, they break apart. So at 12 somite stage, just as this transition is happening here, this is what the animal looks like if it's had delta notch signaling blocked, and this is what its brothers and sisters look like with delta notch signaling working properly. And so there's two sort of hypotheses here. One is that we've sort of switched the clock off, broken it somehow, it's stuck. It does some trajectory of expression in the tissue. Or another hypothesis might be that those cells are still oscillating, but they're no longer in local synchrony with their neighbours. And this was the proposal that Julian Lewis made back in 2000 when he said delta notch signaling perhaps invertebrates. What it's doing is just synchronizing these local oscillators. So we've done some work on that, and also work done by Sharon Amacher's lab. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. So here you see a similar example of columnar cohorts tracked in the animal, and you can see in the wild type or the control treated animal, the good temporal correlation between neighboring oscillators. When we block notch signaling, here's DAPT, you can see the oscillations continue, but they're no longer temporally coordinated. And we can get a measure for that synchrony by calculating an order parameter for those cells, so we can put a number on that. And in the wild type, we see an order parameter of nearly 8. And with DAPT, it's about 0.37, I think, is the level.
Now, I think the amplitude still increases. It's unaffected by the loss of synchrony.
I don't know if it's unaffected, but it certainly still goes up. Qualitatively, it still goes up. I'm going to come to what happens to the slowing in just a sec. So what I want to say here, and this is kind of important, if you have a large population of oscillators and they're completely uncorrelated, then this should be zero. Okay, there should be no correlation in this order parameter. So why is it sitting at 0.37? So the fact is that we're only measuring a few oscillators per animal. And if we redo this in a simulation with a small population size, we can see that actually that's right on the nail for completely desynchronized oscillators. So we think this is quantitative evidence that says that not only is delta notch signaling required for coupling, but it's the only coupling mechanism that's influencing the phase of the neighboring oscillators in the zebrafish. Okay, so
how do you define your order parameter?
How do we define it?
Yeah.
It's a really simple measure. We put the phase of each of the oscillators on a unit circle, and then we, as a vector, and then we divide by the number of oscillators. And so, yeah, if they're all pointing in the same direction, you get a large magnitude. And if they're all pointing in different directions, you average out to a little guy, and that's your... So, thanks, Marta. Okay, now, I'm hammering on about this not so much that we got rid of the coupling, but because we want to be convinced that we haven't got any Delphinox going on there anymore. Because,
just one question. If you look at the top, the wild type on the right, and you look at the green line, the yep. green line has two oscillations and the third one's missing.
Yep.
The red one, it has the extreme oscillations for the central one.
And that one's missing, yeah.
Isn't that surprising if you have the notch delta system to synchronize that you have so much variability within neighboring cells?
Yeah, I'm continually surprised. Yeah, so what you have to, there are papers you can read of simulations of this Delphinox system which are very reliable. You know, good strong coupling strength, everything's working, but when we look at the real animal, we see these things jumping around. I mean, I think in some sense at a cell-to-cell level, the segmentation clock gets it right on average every time, but on a cell-to-cell level, it doesn't. Yeah, I think it's really interesting. So, okay, it looks like there's no... Sorry, Sharon.
Well, you're talking about the stochasticity of the surprising round, but I'm wondering how many copies of the protein are sitting there at any one time.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't know. It's embarrassing, but we don't know. Okay, so here's the key thing. Here's, in case of DMSO, we've got about 20% slowing. Add DAPT... thing desynchronizes, there's no more coupling, and we can't tell the difference. So even though that pattern is completely scrambled, and even though the animal can't put its backbone together anymore in that case, the cells didn't notice. They're slowing their oscillations in exactly the same way. So I think this is really interesting, because it says that although notch signaling is required to maintain this beautiful phase pattern across the tissue, it doesn't generate the phase offset in the tissue. There must be something else that's generating that. Yeah.
I don't know if you said this, the average frequency is changed when the log notch?
Yeah, actually the average frequency is also adjusted by about 15%. So I would say the collective frequency is altered by taking out notch. And we think that has to do with the fact that there are significant time delays relative to the intrinsic period or the natural frequency of these oscillators, and that introduces some interesting effects in the collective frequency that they'll take at in the synchronized state. So basically, when we take out notch signaling, the segments form about 10 to 15% more slowly than they would normally, and they're longer too. So I didn't mention that at all. Here I wanted to just focus on this slowing. So okay. Not to generate that, I'll talk about. So what is? Okay, so now come to this idea about positional information in the tissue. And so there's a lot of work from a number of different labs. We've made some contributions, but I don't think we've really done the lion's share of the work, which has really been done by Hiro Takeda's lab, by Olivier Porquier's lab, and actually by Alexander, in defining this idea of having signals that are distributed across the tissue and are affecting the position where you make a new segment. Okay, I'm going to try and say this very carefully. What are the facts? FGF and Wnt are expressed in the posterior of the animal, and you can measure distributions of signaling states decreasing into the anterior, across that tissue. And retinoic acid is expressed in the formsomites, and you can also measure retinoic acid itself in some kind of a gradient going back this direction across the tissue. And there's, I think, the general idea is that the cells are doing two kinds of behaviors. They are slowing their oscillations, sorry, just to mention this, and they're sort of maturing and becoming determined as a segment. Now, I'm going to call this the wavefront. In the clock and wavefront model, that's kind of what was happening, what's supposed to be happening at the wavefront. The idea is that as a cell moves slowly through the tissue, it can see information from these signaling gradients, And when it gets some appropriate balance between those signals, it sort of triangulates in some way, and it says, right, I've reached the right position in the tissue, and now I make my change. So it could be that when we're talking about having to slow that cycle and get it to cease, maybe these signaling pathways can feed directly onto that negative feedback loop, change the half-life of the protein, we don't know.
What does it set the position of the center of the signaling, like, what the source of the signaling, yes, actually in tissues, as you said, like the presenters are passing by, yes, and like this, yeah, thing, but you just keep like, yeah, the center at one place.
Well, in an amniote, there is a resident population of stem cells here in the tailbone. It could be that they are in charge of that. In the zebrafish, it's not clear how many cells are resident, and it might be that that job itself is also exchanged as new cells flow through the tailbone. So I think it's a bit less clear in the zebrafish. But what's clear from looking at gene expression and protein levels is there's a high level of these proteins that really are maintained in the posterior. Boris.
Well, I guess a couple things. I'm sort of puzzled. So this is still very much the clock and wavefront picture, right? But we were talking a lot about frequencies and slowing down and this and that, which are not terribly important from this point of view, right? So these are just kind of details and so little modifications of the clock, but doesn't really change the big picture. But on the other hand, as for the position of the wavefront, so right now this picture is measuring from the tailbutt, but could it be measured from the anterior side?
It could be. I mean.
But so the statement is that it's possible, but we have evidence for this, but not evidence for the other one.
I think one of
both are hypothetical.
I think one of the big problems here is that when you make perturbations to Wnt, FGF, or retinoic acid, you perturb a lot of things in the vertebrate embryo. You perturb growth rate, you perturb cell survival, and so I think that Alexander, maybe you could give your opinion here, but I'm not sure that we yet have really clear experimental evidence for the roles of these things. What's for sure true is that if you temporarily decrease FGF signaling, you will get a series of longer segments that form. So, and if you temporarily decrease Wnt signaling, you'll get a series of longer segments that form. So we know we can reach up here somehow to the length of the forming segments and push them backwards and forwards by tuning these gradients. There's very good evidence for that. What those perturbations are doing to the slowing is still completely unclear. Whether that's related, whether you could change the slowing and have no effect on the position, or whether you could change the position and not change the slowing. And I think now, with these new transgenic lines, now is when we work that out, I hope. And I'm going to try and do that in just a sec.
Do you know if the production of these... Do you know if the production of these proteins changes over time?
Yeah, it does. It does, actually. So that's a really good point. So I don't think we've measured it yet quantitatively, but from our transgenic lines where we've tagged Wnt, for example, you can see that it changes its level over developmental time. So I think these two sources could change their magnitude during development. Yeah, but that's not a part of, it's not a quantitative part of the picture yet, but I think it's excellent to keep that in mind, that those two things might be changing. Okay, so, yeah, Tassel.
So the distance of the source to the arrest zone, is it constant?
No. No, absolutely not.
So the gradient scales, is there anything known?
No. Nothing's not. So now just distinguish two categories of mechanism here. One is a radio receiver. So here we've got, this is a real positional information kind of model. The cell is moving across the tissue and it's continually updating its local concentration of these signaling sources. And it's going, shall I slow, shall I differentiate, shall I slow, shall I differentiate? And at some point it goes, aha, right, let's do it. Okay, I'm slowing, differentiate. The other one is an idea of gradient by inheritance, which is quite an old idea as well. And this says that the cells pick up some information in the posterior, whatever it is. It could be transcripts of FGF, which has been proposed. Could be transcripts of AXIN, some other Wnt signal. or something else. And as they are displaced across the tissue, they have some sort of internal timer. This is called a gradient by inheritance. Because it's spread out across the tissue, you get a spatial gradient, but it's an internal process. Of course, it could be a mix of these two. And this comes back to the problem of in the intact embryo. So this is where these sort of cultures, I hope, are going to really help us understand. In the intact embryo, it's really difficult. It has been very difficult to tease apart whether the contributions of these kind of things. Okay, so now, in the last 30 seconds, I'm going to talk about this in some experiments that are relatively fresh off the press by going down to the single cell level. And this is an assay that Ravi and Laurel developed in the lab. They've been working on this for about a year and a half or 2 years. And I asked them for a detailed protocol, and I got this. We start with this double transgenic animal because we want to pick out the oscillations and we want the determination at the end. And now, in a feat of microsurgery, Laurel pulls the skin off and then dissects out groups of 150 to 200 cells from the tail bud, mechanically dissociates them, no trypsin, nothing like that, then put them on the microscope, allow them to settle, and they usually sit on some sort of protein-coated glass or PDMS. They do it on just on PDMS too. And we culture them in L15, so there's no serum, no lipids, no extra stuff that might be. So we wanted to try and get the null state, and the idea here was, well, then we're going to add all the gradients, and we're going to understand the role of the gradients, and finally we'll be able to make them differentiate and da-da-da. So we got a surprise, and so we're doing this at very, very low density. You're going to have a whole bunch of questions about what happens when these cells can touch each other during the assay. Please save those questions for the end of the talk, or beer or something, because I don't know the answer. I'm super interested in the answer, but I honestly don't know the answer. So this is just going to deal with single cells. So we do see the cells divide, but they're very difficult to track after they've divided because of the kind of microscopy we're doing. Okay, so tailbone cell in culture. And this is what happens. Here's one of these cells sitting on the bottom. 2, 3, 4, differentiation. So this was, let me just play that again. We had some bets in the lab, and I lost a bit of wine by my predictions because they were wrong. And so this is the activity of these individual cells sitting in the complete absence of any spatial information, any gradients. They've been ripped untimely from the tail bud, so presumably they have some memory of signals they just received. Come back to that in a sec. And this is what it looks like. So you see a couple of features. You see when that switches off, that really goes off. And a rising amplitude, and then a coincidence of the MESP transcription with approximately the last peak. So qualitatively, it looks really like exactly the same program that was being played out in the tailbone of the embryo. So I'm just going to throw, this is now 19 cells from four different individual embryos put together. This, I'm sorry about the colours, but gives you some idea qualitatively, rising amplitude. These are the medians of the traces, and then here's the MESP going on around about in that first peak. So this is still qualitative. This is what we've seen these cells going. We've seen now hundreds of cells doing this. Remember I told you about all the poo falling in our fish tanks on last Friday before? So what I asked Ravi and Laurel to do was to go back to Germany and repeat this whole experiment in Germany on independent fish lines with independent microscopes. So this is robust, it is not poo dependent. So we wanted to analyze it. He couldn't show it, I can. There you go, how about that? So we want a pattern. We want the pattern of the waves, right? So I don't know how many of you saw the LIGO talk yesterday. So he wasn't allowed to use slides, and so he couldn't show the gravitational waves hitting the two detectors. And waves are cool, right? Okay, so we've got oscillations stopping autonomously, and we've got the differentiation marker coming on autonomously, but that wouldn't give you stripes. for stripes, you must, wouldn't give you waves, you must have a slowing. So we can see that here by lining the last peak up on the zero, and again doing this, the ratio of successive peaks. And for this data set, these are separate experiments, but very similar conditions, we can see that overwhelmingly the successive oscillations slow down. So again, these cells have a frequency profile, just as they did in the embryo, that they're exhibiting in vitro. Okay. So
when you're dispersing the cells, do you actually simulate the activation of the LTF pathway by activating that kinase?
We don't know. You mean like, because it could be considered like an injury, and boom, in comes the... So we don't know that. It's possible. We want to look, say, DP-ERK, for example, or something. Those cells ought to already have, they do in the embryo, already have a stimulated FGF pathway. We've measured that, I think, in Roller's paper. You can see those...
But you don't know how that evolves with time.
Don't know yet how that evolves with time. We also haven't done the experiment where we blocked FGF signaling. Yeah. At the same time, to see whether they could still do this paper. So there's an excellent experiment.
So when you said in a previous graph, like you had this cell maturation, when did the cells actually transit from mesodermal protein to structural mesodermal? Is it the sharp transition out of the PSN, getting into the PSN, or you have a gradient?
I don't know. I mean, I think if we look at, we've got markers to a series of T-box transcription factors, which make graded series of ups and downs, and so it really could be quite a gradual series of transitions that they go through. I think it's a good question. I don't really know. I don't know if even maybe other people would know if there's sort of an official definition of loss of T, maybe. When a mesodermal progenitor loses T, maybe it's differentiated as a mesoderm.
I was very struck in your single-cell experiment. I don't know if it's a coincidence or reproducible, but the cell seems to round up as if it would enter mitosis, like it would go into metaphase while the differentiation signal.
Yeah.
Is that?
No, I think that's a coincidence. The cells are really quite active. They've got traveling blebs. They don't move a lot. They don't grip down. In fact, if we do see the cell really grip down, it will not oscillate.
Because this one did.
Yeah, that one did. You can see them sometimes go into total fibroblast grip, and then that is, you never see anything oscillating if it really grips down.
So did you play with the substrate?
Yes, we did. We played with it a lot. And we still don't really understand it, to be honest. I think that would be another way to come back to these guys. Maybe constrain them, or push them, or put them on different substrates. What we were concerned about in this, what I'll show you just next in the remaining 30 seconds, is we were concerned to put them on a substrate that would somehow be neutral, so that we would have some reference point at which to add fibronectin or different laminin, or you know. So in the end, what I'll show you next is we actually ended up using protein A because it's bacterial. And it's not co-isolated with any thing from a cow's serum, for example. And the cells love it. So they don't need any... They like sitting on protein. They don't really care where the protein comes from. If it's bacterial protein, they're fine with that. So, but I think, for example, compliance of the surface would be very, very interesting to look at. This embryo is very soft, but we haven't explored that. I can't
ask that. I guess you could probably tell us that we had robust results about this, but have you thought, started to... You
know,
expose them to different levels of FGF, or...
I come to that half a sec. So I've got 5 minutes before the banana comes out. So let me, just from this qualitative stuff, and then I come to these sort of questions. Wave patterns are generated at a single cell level in the zebrafish. Active signaling from neighboring cells or active signaling from spatial grains is not required. There's no role for an anterior source of retinoic acid Boris signaling in to stop the thing. Doesn't need that. That's right. Go back in. You don't need, you know, asking about that first wave and whether, so you don't need that sort of external starting condition in that sense to get this to. This really deeply supports some sort of gradient by inheritance where the movement of cells is carrying something in it. And we now talk about this internal timer, some sort of slow internal timer that is governing this differentiation trajectory that the cells will do. And so positional information then is really it's really a temporal axis. It's the playing out of some internal timer plus advection that gives you a position in the tissue. That would be the idea boiled down from here. So in that sense, you've got wavefront in a single cell, and the wavefront can't be something independent from the clock. It can't be something supplied in from some other part of the embryo, external signal, independent of the clock. It has to be, in that sense, generated from within that cell. It doesn't mean it has to be a part of the clock, the same molecule, but it's got to be in that cell. So I have nearly run out of time, and I wanted to talk about four kinds of experiments that are hot off the press, which have been done now under what we're trying to get quantitative conditions now, and to address the question about position in the PSM, developmental changes over developmental time, whether this timer becomes determined or it can be re-switched, and how you might modulate it by signaling factors. But I think in the interests of time, I'm actually going to have to talk about that at some other time, unless there's a stay of execution, but I give you the opportunity.
Yeah, we'll organize another time. Absolutely.
Okay. Characteristics of the program. What you can do is basic stuff you can count. The number of peaks. That comes in integers, so sometimes if you're thinking about a timer, you want to know how long it goes. It's maybe better to keep track of the last peak time as a really well identifiable point of when the oscillations are going to stop. The MESP onset time we define as a particular feature of when the curve comes up from the MESP. And I should say that these values are quantitative to within like 2%, 3% from day to day when we do the experiments on things. So if it comes back down here, it's really off. It's stopped. Responsive time. And of course, frequency index is the slowing. Now, I'm not going to talk about all of these things for all of the measurements. Some we don't even know yet. But I wanted to describe four things that we saw. So here's the first question. Does the internal timer, if this really is an internal timer, it should vary with PSM position. If we pull cells out here, which is what I talked about so far, or here, if it's really a timer, then it's almost like we should have tweaked it a different amount round and we should see it running down. So that experiment was done here. So now this is what we've seen. We pull out cells from the tail bud. Here's one example. We pull cells out from a little bit further along the PSM, and here's an example. You can see in this example, this cell has stopped oscillating and has differentiated before this cell. Shouldn't leave two cells, though. Now I'm going to keep track just of the peaks and the onsets. And, oops, just go back on. Okay, so this is now measuring the exit from the PSM with MESP. Here is from one experiment. This is now from one embryo. This embryo cells have been taken and distributed into different wells. From the tail bud, these are the arrest times for MESP. Sorry, the MESP onset times. And here's the posterior PSM. They're shorter, on average, shorter. There's definitely some overlap. We look at the time at which the last peak is made in the tail bud and the last peak in the PSM. And you can see that each of those is shorter. So it looks like, on average, cells are cycling for less time and are differentiating earlier. And for this experiment, all of those cells are shortening. You can see those data points would lie here if they weren't lengthening their oscillations. But all of those cells are lengthening their oscillations before they differentiate. And now we can look at each one of these data points is an experiment like this. And so I'm normalizing to the posterior PSM because these turn out to be the most robust cells to grow, and we know the most about them. So you can see that when we look at MESP onset and oscillation times, these tend to take longer in the culture than the posterior PSM. And now when we go to the anterior PSM, which is here, so you can see it's not right up in the anterior, but it's well separated from these posterior positions, right here. And now we can see that they differentiate much, much earlier. They do either one or two cycles, sometimes only half a cycle, and then they switch the MESP on. So it'd be nice to have some cells here to get some intermediate values, but we think that this data is consistent with that idea of having an internal timer. which whose properties are quite variable, but seem to run down as you go along that axis.
I guess the question is, what throws the timer? Because you have cells that are in residence in the pre-music, at the posterior, so something must
kick it off, right?
Must kick it off.
That's a good question. It could be, in this experiment, what we've done is we've taken the cells out of high-level signaling. So my suggestion, to go back to the embryos now, is any decrease in signaling is enough to kick it off.
Yeah, there's some thresholds below which you...
And now this thing kicks in.
So how can you differentiate between a timer and having an integral, a temporal integral of a signal? So the cell is like flowing and like integrating a signal. Over.
Sure, it could be. I'm not. When I say timer, it's a really broad category. It's something that's keeping track sort of irreversibly of a time process. So it could be by integrating signal.
Can you do the transplantation experiment?
I'm not going to show any of those. It's actually very difficult because of the skin of the zebrafish to get a cell out and put it back somewhere else. But I think we've found a way to do that now. And so that's one of the things we're going to do, is take the cells back. I can speak a little bit to determination with the role of FGF in a sec. Okay, so that's consistent with having an internal timer of some nature. Now, if you go back now to the big picture, the embryo's PSM is shrinking, the number of waves is changing, and here's the chymograph I was talking about before. Now it really is anchored on the posterior. And so everything I've talked about now has been done at 15 somites, which is about here. But look at the 5 somite stages up here. This is a really different looking tissue. Now, if there's some sort of internal timer in those cells, interesting hypothesis, maybe Hox genes playing an unfolding role in the tail bud. You can ask the question whether the internal timer is different when you get cells out at 15 somite stage, where they're going to take 600 microns to differentiate. They'll have 3 waves. 300 microns to get 2 waves. What's going to happen? Okay. Again, I lost wine. We can't tell the difference between the cells we pull out of the tail bud at 5 somite stage and at 15 somite stage. I find this deeply perturbing, because it means that the cells don't know where they are on the axis. Those cells, when we put them into this assay, can't remember where they came from. And yet, if they stayed in the animal, they would have done, I guess, at least twice the number of oscillations and twice the number of times.
There were the experiments of Amour and Fourquier, where I thought they showed that, depending upon the Hox expression, the cells would move into the streak at earlier or later times. So wouldn't that be an obvious signal? Wouldn't that be an obvious age signal? Which obviously, because they were moving cells around in the chick.
Yeah.
And so the Hox genes were relevant to when they would in fact move onto the axis.
I agree, and I guess it's experiments like that that made me think that we would see strong differences between these cells. But the fact is we don't. And so I think that there must be something else in the embryo. Those cells were done by transplanting lots of cells. You had big right. Tissues essentially going across. So what if this timer process, whatever it is actually naive? It could be naive. Maybe there's something else going on in the tail bud that's telling these cells what to do. And so now I want to come back to the role of gradients, to the acute level of the signaling that's going on. And I don't know if this is the right idea, but it could be that at different stages, we know, someone asked about the levels of signaling factors through development, which change. It could be that the Hox genes are giving us more FGF at one time than another. And so there is a gradient. It's not required for this behavior, but it could modulate it. Could that happen? Can the internal timer be influenced by signals? So far we just showed actually that you can see it tick down and that it can't tell where it came from in the animal, but could it nevertheless be talked to? And so here's, I think, the experiment that you wanted to see. So here what we do is we compare the posterior PSM and the anterior PSM. These are the data that I showed you before, and actually these are in quantitative agreement with the stuff I showed you before. The axis is very different size, which is going to warn you about what the cells do when we show them FGF. Okay, the posterior PSM, look at that. So this is MESP onset, and this is the last peak. So actually this cell oscillates more times than it would have if it had stayed in the embryo for the rest of segmentation. I think it oscillates 14 more times, and there aren't 14 more segments coming. when this guy goes in. So, and we don't know. We turned the microscope off because we needed to do another experiment. We don't know what will happen there. And then, but look at the anterior PSM. It's halfway down the PSM. We call it anterior PSM. But look what happened. The cells can't respond to FGF anymore. So this is a big difference. Somewhere along that axis, and somewhere in here actually, those cells lost the ability to respond to the FGF. And we have no idea why that is. Do they lose a receptor? Do they express something else that blocks it? We can only speculate. Let me just say one last thing, and then I stop. I think that these really, really long cells, I don't want to leave you with the idea that they're just beautifully just cruising out there and just doing beautiful slowing. Look how much usually the MESP onset and the last peak are quite well correlated. But look at the difference in these cells. And something really different happened there. I think I've got it here. Yeah, this is, in the spirit of a lab meeting, this is cut straight out of the Evernote diary that we used to... And this also shows you the raw the traces that come out of the image processing. For example, peak calls. Okay, so this you might think looks about normal. It's got a nice number of cycles, rises, stops. Maybe there's a tweak in the MESP here. But look at this one here. That's a MESP onset call. And then got a nice... Oh, wait, and then it keeps oscillating, and then it keeps oscillating. Look at this guy. This just... So something different has gone on here, something maybe pathological. This one's gone into tall. So here, giving the cells FGF can dissociate what we thought was a really important correlation between stopping your last cycle and switching on MESP. Everything from the animal and everything up to now told us that those two things happen together. It makes you even think that one's causing the other, but that can't be true. With FGF, you can flip those two programs into different trajectories. So we don't understand this, but I just wanted to show many, many cells do something normal. But we do see pathological cells, that are longer, but we do see pathological cells where we've been able to uncouple those things. Okay, let me leave it there. Just skip over the retinoic acid. And... Okay, so we think there's an internal timer here in the zebrafish. It's cell autonomous. It ticks down with position in PSM. It doesn't have changes during development, at least at the two time points that we've measured, which are about 5 hours apart. It appears to become... It's responsive to FGF, and that appears to become determined at some point down the tissue where it can no longer be talked to. So there's a bunch of other questions you might want to do, I think. Someone mentioned, you mentioned putting cells back in to challenge them again. Those experiments are underway. Substrate mechanics, cell-cell signals. So put two cells together. Are they now more precise than a single cell? There's a bunch of stuff you could look at. And now the last thing I'll say is, what is the identity of this time? Could be integrating something over time. It could be single component decay. So I call this the radioactive decay model. Cells got something in the posterior, and now that decays away, and that sets some time scale for the cell. When we look at things like nuclear beta catenin and DPERK in the intact embryo, and we block those signaling pathways, those signaling molecules are back to go down to background levels within tens of minutes. And for me, that half-life, that is way, way too short for these behaviors, which now stretch out over hours. So I don't think it can simply be the decay of a component that got in the anterior. It could be that the clock itself is being used as a timer in addition to providing phase for where to put the segment. This dissociation behavior is kind of confusing, if that's true. I don't know if it rules it out, but it could be the clock. It could be integrating the amount of her it's seen along the axis or something. We don't have any good evidence for that. I don't think that's happening, but I can't rule it out. And it could be some other internal timer mechanism, like a cascade of transcription factors. You know the timers that are running in neuroblast differentiation in the Drosophila would be one example where you have a series of transcription factors that switch each other on in sequence and define the unfolding of a well-timed unfolding of... So maybe it's something like this. I don't know. So I leave it there. Thank you very much, and thanks for letting me have a couple of...
confused about like what's the cell file segments. Like, do you think you can extract any information from the orthogonal? Yeah, because that seems to be quite homogeneous, like mostly one-dimensional, like what you're doing so far, also modeling, and like the sort of scenes you have. Do you think you could extract any information from like going perpendicular to that?
Looking at either DB or mediolateral in the intact embryo. Quite possibly. I mean, up to now we really have stuck in one dimension just to try and make the problem as simple as possible. The tissue is very definitely three-dimensional. It's not homogeneous. For example, the cells on the outside of the tissue are different shapes and hold polarity to the ones in the middle. So it could be that is relevant and important.
So, if I understand correctly, the clock and wavefront model died late in the talk when you sort of demonstrated that autonomous cells, will autonomously oscillate and differentiate. So now if I take that point of view, so is it possible to make the post-symmetric mesoderm proliferate a little more and grow faster, and do we therefore predict that the somites will get longer?
If you can increase extension rate by whatever means, that's what you want to do.
You know what, maybe I take it back. It requires a little bit more thought.
I think one way to think about these questions now is to say, instead of saying, what is it that's stopping the oscillators here? You have to say, in some sense, you want to also say, well, what is the cell doing on the way through that will enable it to stop earlier or later than it would have? I think that's the right perspective to have about position information in the tissue. All right. Thank you very much, everyone.